Welcome to the Murder and Mystery Podcast. I'm your host, Summer. Today I have a mystery for us. A mystery that includes broken hearts and the loss of hope of a future. A mystery that has endured since 2007. It gripped the world at that time and has kind of fallen out of everybody's focus, even though there has not been any answers found. The birth of a child can be so amazing. It not only increases your family and brings new hope, it brings questions of the future and promises of a life that we all as parents dream of. I know when my kids were born, I would look at those little babies and wonder what they were going to be like as they got older. What would their teenage selves be? What would they be like as adults? As many parents, I believe, do the same. On May 12, 2003, Kate and Jerry McCann had their first child, Madeline Beth McCann. I believe they looked at this beautiful little baby and they imagined what she would be like as she grew. Would she be more like her mom? Would she be more like her dad? Would she decide to become a doctor like her parents? What was this beautiful little girl going to grow up to be? The family grew in 2005 when they had a set of boy-girl twins. And their family was complete. They had three beautiful kids, a loving home, two loving parents. They were just a normal family, just like everybody else. They worked, they came home, they took care of their kids, they had fun, they loved their family, and they never dreamed that the unimaginable could happen to their family. In 2007, the McCanns had planned a wonderful holiday with their family and their close friends. They had decided to go to Portugal and go to a resort and just have fun. Honestly, I think just like any other family, when you plan a vacation, you look at what can the kids do? What can the adults do? What are we going to do together? How can I make the most of this? How can I let my kids have fun, but how can I also have fun as an adult? The McCanns were going to be attending a resort. However, instead of staying in the resort, they opted to rent an apartment. In fact, all the families that were traveling with them rented these apartments. They were privately owned apartments that were rented by the Mark Warner Company, a British holiday booking company. So they were kind of like an Airbnb. And this allowed the family to be able to be comfortable, to spread out, to have those comforts of home, while also being very close to the resort and all the things that they wanted to do. So on April 28, 2007, they arrived at Praia de Luz in a village in Portugal that had a population of about 1,000 people. This was known as Little Britain due to a high concentration of British homeowners and vacationers. I'm sure this also helped them to feel more comfortable. They felt like the people around them were from their home country. They spoke English. This was an area that catered to vacationers and tourists, so it was going to be safer. And it was a family resort, so they really felt like everything was safe and secure. They were renting these apartments that were right beside the resort, so that they had very quick access to both their apartment, to the resort. They could come and go. They could do all the things that they wanted to do without really worrying about the safety and having to drive long distances and things like that. So the McCanns stayed in apartment 5A, which was a ground floor apartment, had two bedrooms. Matthew and Rachel Oldfield and their daughter stayed next door to the McCanns in 5B. Jane Tanner, Russell O'Brien, and their two children were in 5D, so they were right there as well. And then Fiona and David Payne and their two children, along with Fiona's mother, Diana Webster, had an apartment on the next floor. So they were upstairs, but they were all right there together. The three families had ground floor apartments right beside each other, and then the other family was right above them. 5A, the McCann's apartment, was accessible to the public on two sides, from a sliding glass patio door in the living room, and this was at the back and overlooked the Ocean Club's pool, tennis courts, and the Tapas restaurant and bar where the adults had dinner every night. There was a small gate off a public street that had access to stairs leading up to the patio and the living room. So you have this sliding glass door that overlooked this restaurant, and there was a gate that led to stairs that led up to this, and that gate was off of the road that ran behind the apartments. The front door of the apartment was located on the other side, also off of a public road. So the front of the apartment faced one road, the back of the apartment faced another, where you could access this gate and get to the door going into the living room. The bedroom that the three children slept in was right by the front door. There was one window that was waist high to the room, and that window had curtains and had exterior metal shutters controlled by a string. And the family kept the curtains and the shutters shut so nobody could look in and see that the children were sleeping in that room. This room was overlooked a narrow walkway and the residence parking lot. So the window to that room overlooked the parking lot and was accessible to the road by a short wall that could be stepped over and climbed over, and you could go and be right there at the window. Within the bedroom, Madeline slept in a single bed by the door, and the twins slept in another single bed that was underneath the window. So Madeline was by the door, the twins were by the window. And that's kind of the setup of this apartment, which comes into play here in just a bit. Every day, this family had kind of the same routine. And this can also be important when you think about people watching them and kind of figuring out what their routine is, where everybody's at and what's going on. So each day, the children spent time at the kids' club and the adults did their own activities. And then after the children had eaten dinner and had settled into bed that night, the adults had a table reserved at the Tapas restaurant, which was just right across from these apartments. And they would go there and they would have dinner there every night. Now, during this time, the adults went back and checked on their kids. They checked about every 30 minutes, going and making sure that their kids were okay and that everything was good. But they did this every night. They were actually nicknamed the Tapas Seven because they had reserved this table and they attended this restaurant every night that they were there. Thursday, May 3rd, 2007 is a date that will forever be imprinted on this family's heart and in their head. This is the fateful day that the unimaginable happened to this family. And it started off kind of odd. So I'm sure looking back, these parents probably think, you know, this was our sign that something was wrong. something was going on. Maybe something had been going on the whole time. But, you know, when you're on vacation and things are just happening and you're doing all these different things, vacation can be pretty chaotic sometimes. And so you don't really stop and think about what's out of the ordinary, because on vacation, everything's out of the ordinary. That morning on May 3rd, over breakfast, Madeline asked her parents why they didn't come when she and her brother had cried the night before. So obviously, if their kids were getting up pretty regularly and they knew that their kids got up regularly, they wouldn't have left their kids to go eat dinner. This was something that was unusual. These kids, once they were in bed and they were asleep, they didn't really get up during the night. So for them to wake up and be crying and nobody was there was unusual. Plus, remember, they were being checked on every 30 minutes. So I'm sure Kate was just like, well, you know, somebody came back and checked on you within 30 minutes. So you couldn't have been too upset because you were back asleep when we came back to check. But she did notice something odd. There was a brown stain on Madeline's top. And this was a stain that she didn't remember before. And at that time, she kind of shrugged off. But later, when everything happened, she remembered she had a stain on her top. And she didn't know where she got the stain. But again, everything when you're on holiday is out of the ordinary. So she just shrugged this off. And she took her children to the kids' club that morning, where they had activities, they had fun. Kate and Jerry went on and they did their adult activities. They had fun. And then Kate went and picked up her children at lunchtime, took them back to the apartment. The family had lunch together. And then they all went to the pool and they swam for a little bit. After swimming for a while, she took her children back to the kids' club to do afternoon activities, and she and Jerry went off and did adult afternoon activities. And then about 6 o'clock, she went and picked her kids up and took them back to the apartment. Again, this was very typical. This is the routine they had been in since they arrived at this resort, at the apartments. Every day they did the same routine. She put the kids to bed about 7. And then when they were good and asleep, she and Jerry left the apartment at 8:30 and went over to the Tapas restaurant with their friends. So I told you this restaurant was very close to the resort. In fact, from their apartment, it was 180 feet straight across to the restaurant and the table that they were at. However, because the resort was fenced off and they weren't staying in the resort, you couldn't go directly from the apartment to the restaurant. You had to go out onto the road and around to the front of the resort and then back to the pool and the restaurant area. So it wasn't quite as easy, quite as quick to get there, but it was really only 180 feet from the table that they were sitting at to the apartment. Now, the other thing is you could see the apartment from their table, but because of the things that were out and around the pool, you couldn't see a good view of the apartment. Like, you couldn't see the side of the apartment. You couldn't see who was over at the apartment, if anybody was walking around over there. All you could see was the roof of the apartment, the tops of the apartment. So while it was so close, it also was so far away. You know, they didn't have the access to the apartment like they would have if they had been staying in the resort. It wasn't as close as it really seemed. Okay, so some other things that are really important to know as we are talking about this day. First off, The McCanns had left the patio door closed, and they had drawn the curtains, but they left the front door unlocked. This way, it would be easier for them to get in to check on the children. They wouldn't have to use the key to open the door. They also could do it quieter and not wake up the kids with rattling keys and stuff while they tried to go in and check on them. Another important factor to know in this is that the family had reserved their table at the Tapas restaurant when they first arrived. So not only were they going through the same routine every day, going back to the same restaurant every evening without their children, but they had reserved this table. Not only did they reserve the table, but at the swimming pool, in their swimming pool reception area, there was a message book. And in this message book, one of the resort staff had written a note saying that the group needed the same table every night as their children were asleep in the apartments. So anybody who went up could see that this group, the Tapas seven, these adults who were coming there every night, needed that exact table every night because their children were asleep at the apartments that were directly across the pool area from the restaurant. And that table overlooked those apartments. So those are two things to consider. The front door was unlocked, and there was this note stating that the children were asleep in the apartments. They followed the same routine every day, and every evening, these families who were going back and forth from the resort to the apartments, dragging their young children back and forth, all these adults were now coming over to this restaurant without their children. Those are just some things to consider, to keep in the back of your mind as we continue to go through this fateful night. So, the McCanns and their friends started the evening at 8:30 over at the Tapas restaurant, where they were eating and just having conversation and enjoying their time together. But just like every other night, the adults took turns every half hour leaving the restaurant and going to check on the children. So Jerry was the first one to leave the restaurant at 9:05 that evening to check on the McCann children. When he got there, they were asleep, but there was something odd about the house. He remembers when he and Kate initially left the house at 8:30 to walk over to the restaurant, they had pulled the kids' door almost all the way shut. They left it open a crack so that they could get some light into the room, but they had pulled it mostly closed. When he got there, the door was completely open. He thought that was odd, but kind of shrugged it off, just like the stain on Madeline's shirt that morning. It was just kind of shrugged off. Odd things happen. Maybe we weren't paying attention. I just thought about it. I thought I did it. Maybe Kate opened it after we'd closed it. Maybe one of the kids had gotten up and went to the bathroom and had opened it. So he pulled it back shut to where it was just open a crack, and he left the apartment to go back to the restaurant. Jane Tanner had gone to check on her own daughter shortly after 9. She saw Jerry talking to a man who was also on holiday while he was on his way back to the restaurant. So she had left shortly after Jerry, maybe. She went and checked on her daughter. He had checked on their kids. He had left and had stopped on the way back to the restaurant and was talking to another man that was also on holiday, and neither Jerry nor the man that he was talking to remembered seeing Jane. So they were engrossed in their conversation, they're talking. They don't remember seeing her walk by, but she remembers seeing them talking as she walked by. Around 9:15, Jane said she saw a man carrying a young child. He was near the McCann's apartment, and he was moving from the direction of the children's bedroom window, but he was on the street. So remember, there was the kid's window, and that was accessible if you went over the short wall, and it was right there by the road. He was close to that, but he was on the road. He wasn't in the apartment area. He was on the road, and he's carrying the child. And she was walking past to go check on her child, and she saw this. Jerry and the man that he was talking to didn't see a man carrying a child, but they also didn't see Jane walk by them. Jane says that the man was white, of Southern European or Mediterranean descent, had dark hair, was about 5'7", and between the ages of 30 and 40, he was wearing gold or beige trousers and a dark jacket. She gave the police this description later on. Another sighting of a man carrying a young child was reported by Martin and Mary Smith. They reported seeing a man of the same description as Jane. So these are people that were not part of that Topaz 7. They weren't talking together. They didn't know that Jane had seen this man and made this report. But they reported seeing a man who looked very similar to Jane's description, carrying a small child. They stated he did not look like a tourist, but he did seem uncomfortable carrying the child. It wasn't like this is a man who carried this child like this all the time. However, the man was in the same area and moving from the direction of the McCann's apartment. So he was in the same direction, same description, carrying this child, looked kind of uncomfortable while he was doing it, looked like he was probably a local. At 9:30, okay, so an hour after the party had gone over to the Topaz restaurant, and about 20-30 minutes after Jerry McCann had last checked on his kids, Matthew Oldfield offered to check on the McCann children when he went to check on his own children in the next door apartment. So he was going that way. He said, I'll look in on your kids too. And so he got there and he reported going into the apartment, and he said the children's door was open. He listened. He didn't hear any noise. So he went ahead and left without going into the apartment and looking in the bedroom. So he, remember, their bedroom is right by the door. He just opened the door, stepped in. The bedroom door was open. He didn't hear anything. He didn't see kids up. So he just pulled the door shut and went and checked on his own daughter and left. So 10 o'clock, 30 minutes after Matthew Oldfield went to check, Kate went to check on the children. She got there and she noticed that the children's door was open. And when she went to shut the door, it slammed. So that's kind of important. You know, when you have like a window or another door open and you go to pull a door, you know, the suction can make it slam. So when that slammed, she knew something was up. So she opened the door and looked in, and that's when she noticed that the bedroom window to the kids' room and the shutters were open. Remember, the shutters that opened, they were on the outside, but they opened with a chain on the inside. So that window was closed, those shutters were closed, and the curtains were closed when they left. They made sure that those were always closed so nobody could look in and see the children in their beds. And now the window's open, the shutters are open, and that was not the way that they left it. Also, that bedroom door was open. Remember when Jerry went in, he pulled the door shut. And he thought that the door had been shut or mostly shut when they left. He pulled it back shut. 30 minutes later, Matthew Oldfield goes in, the door's open. Kate goes, the door's open. So she opens the door back up, she sees the window, and she notices that Madeline is not in her bed. She goes and she checks the apartment and she doesn't find her. So she ran back to the restaurant yelling that her daughter was missing. Now I can imagine, you know, she checked around the apartment thinking she's gotten up and she's gone to the bathroom. Well, then when she wasn't in the apartment, the window's open. Maybe she opened the window and she climbed out the window. So I can imagine she probably kind of looked around. She called her name and then she ran back to the apartment. At 10:10, Matthew Oldfield went to the resort's reception desk and asked them to call the police because the little girl was missing and they needed to hurry up and find her. By 10:30, the resort had activated their missing child protocol and 60 staff and guests began searching the area for Madeline. This search continued until 4:30 in the morning, and at this point, they assumed she'd woken up and she'd wandered out of the apartment and was lost. Now, it doesn't say that Jane said anything to them about seeing a man carrying a child. She probably saw this, but you wouldn't really think there's a man carrying a child and he kidnapped a child out of one of these apartments and that's my friend's child. Even after all of this, they were still operating on that. She left the apartment on her own. It would have been easy. She could have gotten turned around. You know, she's a little kid. It's dark. It looks different than it did during the day. She can't find her mom and dad. So she's probably around there somewhere. I just think it's very impressive that this resort within 30 minutes had that many people up and going and searching the area for this child. They got that in place very quickly. Two officers from the Gendarmerie, which is the police force that deals with civilians, arrived at 11. So they called the police at 10:10. It wasn't until 11 that the police actually arrived. At that point, there were already people doing a search. They briefly searched for Madeline, and when they didn't find her, they called the criminal police or the Policia Judiciaria. The criminal police arrived at 1 in the morning. So there are big gaps of time where the police just were not involved in the very beginning of this search. At 2 o'clock, they brought in patrol dogs. And at 8 that morning, they brought in 4 search and rescue dogs. Using these dogs, they searched waterways, wells, caves, sewers, and ruins around the area. They did not set up roadblocks until 10 o'clock the next morning. 12 hours after this child was reported missing, they set up roadblocks to try and find this child. Do you know how far you can be from that place within 12 hours? So 5 days after Madeline went missing, Interpol issued a global missing persons alert. So they started thinking, okay, let's look globally. She's not been found in this small little area. Something had to have happened to her. She didn't just wander out of her apartment and she's lost. Now there could be something and enough time has passed. There's no telling where this girl is. So then let's look at suspects. So the first suspect in this case was named 12 days after Madeline disappeared. His name was Robert Murat. He was a 34-year-old British Portuguese property consultant. So Robert Murat was born in London, but currently lived in his mother's house, which was located 150 yards in the direction that the man from the Tanner sighting, Jane Tanner, 150 yards in the direction that she saw this man walking. So remember, she saw this man walking. It looked like he was walking from the direction of the apartments. He was near the area where the window was. He was on the road. It looked like he was walking from that direction. And 150 yards in the direction he was walking toward is this man's house. He became a suspect when a newspaper reporter told police that he was asking about the disappearance. So this man had kind of insinuated himself into the investigation and was asking questions about this disappearance. Murat stated he wanted to help in the case because he had a daughter about Madeline's age in England. So his version of this was, I was really wanting to help because it was tugging at my heartstrings. I have a daughter this age. I want to help this little girl. The McCanns and their friends, the Topaz Seven, reported seeing Murat outside apartment 5A shortly before Madeline disappeared. This sighting was corroborated by the Ocean Club nanny and two British vacationers. However, Murat's mother stated he was home all evening. So now these friends are saying, oh yeah, we saw him outside of the apartment. He was there. And other people are saying, yeah, that guy was there. I saw that guy. He was in the area of the apartment. But he and his mother are saying, no, I was home all evening. I didn't leave. But he became a suspect. Murat's home, cars, computers, phones, and videotapes were searched. His pool was drained. His property was searched using ground-penetrating radar and search dogs. And all of his associates were questioned. No evidence was ever found tying him to the disappearance. In 2017, Murat's mother made public statements that she had seen a woman in a plum-colored dress acting suspicious outside of the apartments that evening and had also seen a brown car driving the wrong way on a one-way street toward the apartments. She stated she reported these incidents to the police. So the mother is now saying that I saw these people, this woman, and this suspicious car, so it couldn't be my son, but these people, I already told the police about this. Witnesses reported seeing men hanging around near the apartment looking odd and suspicious. I don't know how you look odd and suspicious. Were they hanging around using binoculars? Were they peeping in windows? I don't know, but they said they looked odd and suspicious. Police stated that there had been several burglaries in the area, and the burglars were entering windows in that area to burgle these homes. So, I don't know, were these guys dressed all in black with black beanies and peeking in windows, sneaking around houses? I don't know. But witnesses reported men collecting money for charity in the area, including one bedraggled-looking man collecting for an orphanage that they say did not exist. So it seems that there were some men that were possibly canvassing the area in the guise of collecting money for a charity. The people who rented the apartment before the McCanns reported finding a man standing on their balcony, having entered by the stairs coming from the street. So remember the gate that you could open at the street and come up the stairs to their balcony. So they reported that a man was standing on their balcony. And when they confronted him, he said he was collecting money for an orphanage. They said this man was clean shaven, was polite, looked decent, but he was standing on their balcony and didn't go to their front door. The day of Madeline's disappearance, witnesses reported two men with black hair approaching individuals around the apartments collecting money for a hostel or a hospice. So there were two men in the apartment area that was going door to door collecting money for a charity that, you know, they could have been canvassing, looking for places that might be easy to break into and steal things. A Caucasian man with short blonde hair in his mid-30s and described as being ugly, having spots on his face, was seen around the apartment and the resort in the days leading up to Madeline's disappearance. So apparently this ugly blonde man was seen numerous times in the area. I don't know if he was also trying to collect money for charity or if he was just hanging around, if he was hiding behind trees. I don't know, but they said that they saw him in the area. On April 29th, he was seen at the Ocean Club. So he was seen inside the resort. On April 30th, he was seen across the street from the apartments and looked like he was watching them. I don't know, hiding behind trees, watching the apartments. He was also seen near the apartments looking toward a white van that was parked nearby. On May 3rd, the day of the disappearance, he was seen on the balcony of apartment C, which was empty. This was apartment C. It was like right there beside where the McCann's apartment. Remember, they had B, or they had A, and then their friends had B, and then there was C, which was empty, and then they had other friends that were in D. He was seen again around the stairwell of the apartments. That day, another blonde man was seen around the apartments, and at one point, the two men were seen in the street talking in raised voices, which they quietened when they realized that they had been seen. When they saw people looking, they got quieter and started talking quieter, but nobody knows what they were saying. In the late afternoon of May 3rd, a woman standing on her balcony saw a blonde man leaving from a ground apartment in the area of the McCann's apartment. She reported this because the man stopped and looked around before leaving the gate and closing it quietly behind him. So this was in the area. It wasn't necessarily their apartment, but it was right there by their apartment. And remember, he had been on the balcony of the empty apartment in that area. May 12th, the Portuguese police say they believe Madeline was abducted, but still alive and in Portugal. On May 15th, the McCann set up Madeline's fund, Leave No Stone Unturned, to raise awareness about their missing daughter. The website attracted 58 million hits in the first 2 days. I told you in the beginning of this was huge. Everybody in the world knew Madeline's face. She was plastered all over magazines, news reports. They were making sure they were getting the word out everywhere. May 15th, 2007, Robert Murat was named a suspect. May 26th, the police issued a description of a man seen on the night of Madeline's disappearance, possibly carrying a child. Remember, Jane Tanner saw this person, but also the Smiths had seen this person. So there were two witnesses who had seen a person carrying a child. And I don't believe that that description of the person was a blonde man, but we don't know. There were blonde men seen around there, but there were also dark-haired men seen around there. So maybe they were part of the same ring. And then Robert Murat was named as a suspect. On May 30th, 2007, the McCanns flew to Rome to meet with the Pope and the Archbishop of Westminster. So they're starting to bring in powerful people that they can make connections with that can help them with this investigation. June 1st, a forensic team arrived at the apartment to conduct their investigation. They found DNA from a stranger, but the apartment had been left empty and unsealed for a month before they arrived. They didn't have forensics go into the apartment after Madeline was taken. It took them until June 1st to get forensics in there. The Portuguese police admitted vital forensic clues may have been compromised or destroyed because the scene was not protected. In June 2007, the McCanns arranged balloons to be released in over 300 cities around the world to help raise awareness. June 28, 2007, the McCanns suggested the police elicit the help of former police officer Daniel Krugel, who had developed a matter orientation system. This was a handheld device that he claimed could locate missing people using DNA and satellite signal. So this sounds kind of weird, but they were extremely desperate at this point. And they gave this man Madeline's hair that they had collected, and he claimed that he got a static signal from an area of the beach near Rocha Negra Cliff. So this made police more suspicious of the family, because now they're saying, oh, this magical device can use DNA and satellite and help find missing people, and we found this signal over here. So they believed that Kate was pushing to use this device and psychics to point the police toward Madeline's body without implicating herself. They believed that she had done something, had placed her body somewhere, and was giving nudges to these other people and using them to find the body so that she wouldn't look guilty. But nothing was ever found in this area. July 2007, two dogs were brought in, Keela and Eddie. Keela was a trained forensic investigation dog. She was trained to alert on scents of blood by placing her nose close to the spot and freezing. Eddie was an enhanced victim recovery dog, or a cadaver dog. He was trained to give a bark alert to the smell of human death. He could detect death smells even if the body had been incinerated and was buried or was in water. So he could smell bodies pretty well. He could pick up that odor of death. So they brought in these two dogs in July 2007. And first, the dogs were taken to the apartment where the McCanns had stayed. Both dogs alerted behind the couch, and Eddie, remember the one that was trained to detect human death? He alerted near a wardrobe in the main bedroom. They were then taken to the beach and the wastelands, but they made no alerts there. They were taken to the house the McCanns had rented after Madeline's disappearance because, you know, they needed to be out of that apartment. And they wanted to stay close during the investigation. So they took them to this house, and the house and grounds were searched by the dogs. Eddie only gave an alert on a stuffed animal called Cuddle Cat that was laying in the living room floor. Keela didn't give any alerts. The dogs were taken to another location where boxes of clothing and items that were taken from the home were brought. Eddie alerted to one of the boxes of clothes. Family and friends say this could be because Kate was a doctor and she comes in contact with corpses. If he could smell the smell of death and stuff, maybe she had that smell on her and on her clothes or something. And so they were alerting to these boxes. On August 6th, the police took the car the McCanns had rented to an underground parking garage. There were 10 cars in the garage, parked 20 to 30 feet apart, and this included the McCann's car and the Murat's car, and Robert Murat. Remember the one that is the suspect? Eddie gave an alert on the McCann's car outside of the driver's door. He didn't alert on any other cars, and Keela alerted to the rear driver's side inside the trunk and the map compartment in the driver's door, which contained a key ring and a key. The key ring was placed in a bucket of sand, and Keela alerted on the bucket. She alerted on the bucket again when it was moved to a different floor, so she kept alerting on this key ring. Almost immediately, the press began to run stories claiming Madeline had died in the apartment. Hairs and fibers were collected and sent to forensic labs for testing. And these samples arrived at the lab on August 8, 2006. So that was a long time after this baby disappeared that they're just taking forensics, that they're looking through the apartment, that they're trying to figure this out. It was like they just wasted so much time and gave a lot of time for evidence to be messed up. So this was 100 days since Madeline disappeared, and the investigators publicly acknowledged that she may not be found alive. On August 8th, without waiting for lab results, the regional director of Portuguese police, Guillermo Encarnacao, told the McCanns the case was now a murder inquiry and no longer being looked at as an abduction case. So this was August 8, 2007. In 2010, Guillermo Encarnacao died of stomach cancer, and it was revealed he was leaking information about the case and the McCanns to the press. September 3rd, 2007, the test came back from fibers and the reports were inconclusive. Basically, they found 37 DNA components in the fibers and hairs that were sent to them. Of these, 15 matched peaks in Madeline's DNA profile, which contained 19 peaks. So Madeline's DNA profile had 19 peaks, and there were 15 matched peaks from these hair profiles, but there were 37 DNA components, and only 15 of those matched. However, there were at least 3 and up to 5 different contributors that could, and they could not say if the matches were coincidental or truly indicated the presence of Madeline's DNA. So, I mean, these could have been DNA from relatives. I mean, there's so much because they waited so long and they didn't secure the scene. It could have been just coincidence. September 6th, Kate McCann was interviewed at length. Despite the forensic report being inconclusive, Portuguese police proposed Kate admit Madeline died in an accident in the apartment and she hid the body. They told her she would only serve 2-year sentence and her husband would be free to leave the country. The couple were advised by their attorney not to answer any further questions. So now the police are feeding her stories and saying, you need to say this. September 7th, the McCanns were named as suspects by the Portuguese police. The Portuguese press started running stories stating DNA evidence was 100% matched to Madeline's and that her corpse was placed in the trunk of the car and clumps of Madeline's hair had been found in the car. So now they're being persecuted by the Portuguese press. On September 9th, the McCanns flew back to England on the advice of their attorney because they're basically being attacked, being told, you know, just say this and it'll go easier on you. September 10th, the Portuguese police completed and signed a 9-page report stating Madeline had died in the apartment as a result of an accident. It stated the meal at the Tapas restaurant and the checks on the children were a cover-up by the McCanns and their friends. The report stated the group had misled police with false stories of an abduction. September 21st, the U.S. ambassador to Portugal, Al Hoffman, attended a meeting with the British ambassador, Alexander Ellis. According to Hoffman, the British police also had evidence against the McCanns, and officials for both countries were working cooperatively. So on September 21st, 2007, a few months after Madeline's disappearance, everybody's working toward this concept that the parents did something to Madeline. Either there was an accident or they murdered her and they hid her body. On October 2nd, 2007, Chief Inspector Goncalo Amaral, who was acting as the inquiry coordinator, was removed from the case and transferred. He had been named a suspect in relation to another child abduction case that he had worked in 2004, just one day before Madeline had disappeared. So this inspector who was acting as the coordinator for this investigation had actually been named a suspect in a different abduction. He had been named a suspect the day before Madeline disappeared, but he still got to work as the coordinator for Madeline's abduction. So the Portuguese police just keep digging themselves a bigger and bigger hole, making a big mess with everything. So this disappearance that this chief inspector was involved in and was named a suspect in, Joanna Cipriano was an 8-year-old Portuguese girl who disappeared from Figueira, only 7 miles from where Madeline disappeared. Joanna's mother and uncle were convicted after confessing, but the girl's mother recanted, stating that she had been beat by police and made to confess. There was never a body found. There was never a murder weapon found. Now, remember, police had told Kate that if she would confess, she would only get 2 years in prison and her husband would be free to go home. So now this woman is saying, they beat me. They made me confess. There's no body. There's no murder weapon. There's nothing to say that she actually had done what she said she did. So Amaral, the chief inspector, was convicted of perjury in May 2009 and received an 18-month suspended sentence. So it's just a big mess over there in Portugal. November 7th, Jerry McCann releases a video stating he believes his family was watched by a predator in the days before his daughter's disappearance. So remember, there were men that were seen around that area, and it had been reported by other people in the area, in the apartments, that these men had been there and had been kind of watching and lurking. July 21st, 2008, the Portuguese Attorney General announced there was no evidence to link the McCanns or Robert Murat to Madeline's disappearance. He lifted their suspect status. So now they have no suspects. The McCanns aren't a suspect. Murat isn't a suspect. July 24, 2008, Goncalo Amaral, remember the one that was convicted of perjury? And he left the police force the month before and published a book about the case titled Maddie, The Truth of the Lie. So the McCanns began a libel action case against Amaral and his publisher, and they went back and forth with the McCanns, filing and winning a suit, and then Amaral would appeal, and he would win, and then they would win, and this went back and forth from 2009 until 2017, when Portugal's Supreme Court ruled the McCanns had not been cleared by the archiving of the criminal case. So they're saying, no, we can't say for sure that you didn't do this, so there's no libel. January 20th, 2008, the McCanns released sketches of a suspect based on the description from a witness of a creepy man. I don't know what creepy is, but a creepy man seen at the resort. April 2008, the Portuguese police fly to the UK to sit in on interviews with the McCanns' friends who were at dinner on the night Maddie disappeared. July 21st, 2008, so here we are a year after the disappearance, the Portuguese Attorney General announces there is no new evidence November 3rd, 2009, new images of how Madeline might look at the age of 6 were released. In March 2010, the McCanns criticized the release of previously unseen Portuguese police files detailing possible sightings of Madeline to British newspapers. April 2010, Jerry McCann stated it was frustrating that the police were not actively looking for his daughter and hadn't been for a long time. In November 2010, the McCanns published a deal to write a book about their daughter's disappearance. This book was released in May 2011. So now they've written a book about the disappearance. In April 2011, British Prime Minister David Cameron asked Metropolitan Police to help with the investigation. So they began reviewing the case. April 2012, so a year later, Police Detective Andy Redwood tells BBC that his team is seeking to bring closure to the case. They released a new computer-generated image of what Madeline would look like at the age of 9. The next day, the Portuguese authorities announced they will not be reopening an investigation into her disappearance. So the British police are saying, we're going to find closure, we're working on this, and the Portuguese police say, nope, we're not reopening the investigation. May 2013, UK detectives review the case report, identifying a number of persons of interest in the case. July 2013, Scotland Yard announces having new evidence and new witnesses and is opening a formal investigation. October 2013, Scotland Yard detectives identified 41 potential suspects. A BBC Crime Watch appeal featured images of a man carrying a blonde-haired child about the time that Madeline disappeared. Portuguese police reopened their investigation to run alongside Scotland Yard, citing these new lines of inquiry. So these are people that they already knew. These were people that were already in the report. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, you've got some new evidence, so we're gonna open up our investigation again. But their evidence was coming from the report that the Portuguese had written. January 2014, British detectives fly to Portugal, and there are claims they're planning to make an arrest. June 2014, searches of the area where Madeline went missing are carried out, including an area of scrubland that sits southwest of the Ocean Club complex, but they didn't find anything. In July 2014, there were also 4 suspects that were interviewed, but no new developments. September 2015, the British government discloses the investigation has already cost more than £10 million. April 2017, the 4 local official suspects are ruled out, but officers say they're now pursuing significant lines of inquiry. In June 2019, the UK government says it will continue to fund the Metropolitan Police inquiry until March 2020. In June 2020, the police reveal that a 43-year-old German prisoner identified as Christian Bruckner was named a suspect. German investigators classify the investigation as a murder inquiry and state they assume Madeline is dead. Bruckner is being investigated on 3 cases of rape, 2 cases of child molestation, and a 2017 charge alleging he exposed himself and masturbated in front of a group of children. So this is a great guy. Christian Bruckner today continues to be a suspect and the best lead in the case of Madeline. However, he denies any responsibility. So there is evidence against Bruckner. His cell phone being tracked at or close to the crime scene on the night of the abduction. So his cell phone was close to the area where Madeline was abducted. He matches the description of the man witnesses saw on the night. So he matches descriptions of a person that was seen in the area, but he continues to just be a suspect. He hasn't been charged. A well-known clairvoyant who's helped German police find several missing people has stated she was murdered and buried in the woods 6 miles from where she was abducted. This clairvoyant even gave police the exact coordinates, but this claim has been dismissed. So I don't know. It just said the claim has been dismissed. I don't know that they actually went there and just didn't find anything. So there are so many concerns about this investigation. So although a 3-year-old girl goes missing from her apartment in a foreign country in the middle of the night, it took hours for police to arrive, and then 3 hours after that for the criminal police to arrive. So they weren't jumping at, you know, helping this family and looking for this missing girl. The crime scene wasn't secure, and there were several people in and out of the apartment. That evening, a police officer put tape across the children's bedroom, but he left at 3 in the morning, and the apartment was left insecure. So there was just police tape across that bedroom door, and the apartment was left open for anybody to come and go. At least 20 people were documented to have been in and out of the apartment before it was secured. Crowds of spectators were gathered right in front of the apartment door and outside of the children's window. Remember, the window was open, so somebody could have crawled in or out of that window, but people were trampling all over that. The bedroom window's exterior shutters were dusted by an officer who was not wearing gloves. The apartment was left empty for a month before forensics went through the home. And at this time, DNA from strangers were found, and there were so many people that had been in and out of the apartment, and it was left unsecure. They couldn't confirm anything. The apartment was then released and rented out to tourists until August 2007, when forensics came back and sealed it off for more testing. What was the point in that? There were no house-to-house searches. There were no calls to border or marina police to help with the search. Roadblocks weren't put up for 12 hours after she went missing. Motorway surveillance and photos were not requested. Not all the guests in the resort were questioned, and several people came forward on their own contacting British police saying, "I saw something, I heard something, and nobody asked me." So this case was severely mishandled by the Portuguese police. And although German police are positive Madeline was killed by Bruckner, her parents continue to hold out hope that she's alive. So I said at the very beginning of this that some new things had come to light and this case had come to the surface again just this past year. There was a girl on TikTok that was saying that she believed she was Madeline McCann. So she had the same deformity in the eye that made her eye very unique. And this is kind of a rare thing, but there are other people that have the same deformity. But she was saying that, you know, she felt like she had been kidnapped, that her parents had kidnapped her, that things didn't add up. There were just all these things that made her think that she was Madeline McCann. However, DNA showed that she wasn't Madeline. So there for a while, she's saying all these things. It came to light. The McCanns, I'm sure, were really excited. Is she really alive? Is this really her? But it wasn't. And as of today, there are still no new evidence. There isn't anything. She's never been found. Her body's never been found. So I just implore, if you know anything at all, if there's anything you can do to help solve this case, please let authorities know. Because there is family out there. These parents are hurting. They want to know what happened to their child, and they deserve closure. So please come forward if you know anything. Until next time, bye.